cliffcentral.com.
You are now listening to the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. Thanks for tuning in. I'm joined in studio by my very silly co-hosts who are laughing about something. Gushel Brooks and Greg Nicholson, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us, Kingsley.
Good guys. It's serious times in the country, man. We can't be laughing, man. This is hectic times, man.
No, indeed. But of course, that's not why I'm laughing. But anyway, how are you doing, bud?
No, I'm being silly, man. What I actually want to talk about today is the relations between South Africa and the rest of the continent, especially given the xenophobic violence we've seen over the past few weeks, and how that's been playing out. Now, I was reading over the weekend the press release from the Department of International Relations. I don't know if you guys have you guys had a chance to read that through.
Yeah, I've seen bits and pieces of it, or I've seen extracts of it, where basically coming out and saying that this is an overreaction coming through from the Nigerian government. Which, yeah, to some extent I would agree with, but I mean, I think that in the game of diplomacy, this is how things tend to happen. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I was reading through, and it didn't read like your regular press statement like, at all. Just quickly read through, and it says, when 84 of our citizens perished on Nigerian soil, we didn't blame the Nigerian government for the deaths. And then the last line, which
context.
Is, and this is the one that really like sort of blew me away. And it says, we shall also continue to support and not blame the Nigerian government as it battles to deal with Boko Haram. We hope that the more than 200 girls kidnapped will someday be reunited with their families.
Nah, it's a low show. Like, it's a low blow.
I mean, and I know it's a bit, man, it's like...
It's ridiculous. I mean, you know, the thing is, there's a big difference between xenophobia, when citizens of a country go on the rampage and they're busy looting people's shops and killing people in the process, right? Versus one guy that sets up a church and the church collapses on people and kills those people in the process. I really don't think that you can assign blame to the Nigerian government for what... TB Joshua's church had, you know, what had happened at TB Joshua's church.
What though we might be able to assign blame to the Nigerian government for is how long it took to get those bodies back.
Yeah.
I think that was one of the things. We had South African families waiting here for, you know, around 80 bodies for months and months, and the South African government did not, they were actually sort of tiptoeing around this issue. They didn't push the Nigerian government. They didn't force them. They didn't speak out strongly against them. They cooperated and worked together to try and eventually bring those bodies back. Well, it did take a ridiculous amount of time.
No, absolutely. I remember you and I talking about it when they sent Jeff Radebe over there to sort of personally sort of represent the government. And at least publicly, it seemed like the South African government was quite understanding in that situation.
Look, the thing is, I do understand that, and I agree with you. But I mean, within the diplomatic game, right? And please remember what I said right at the beginning. I do think that this is an overreaction from Nigeria on a diplomatic level.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily have to withdraw an ambassador because of the situation. Because maybe you want to say that, you know, South Africa, you've had the warnings. You know that there's high levels of xenophobia and acrimony towards foreign nationals, and you haven't dealt with it efficiently. But to actually withdraw an ambassador is a step too far. However, simultaneously, this press release and having our government pointing out the fact that, this number of South Africans have died, and number two, we hope that you do something about
your own issues.
It's pretty snide. I mean, it's unnecessary. It doesn't help. It doesn't help add any value to this diplomatic debate.
I think there are three things we need to point out. First of all, The Nigerian Foreign Minister, Aminu Wale, didn't recall their High Commissioner to South Africa. They invited him back to Nigeria for discussions around these issues, around the issues of xenophobia. So it's slightly less of a diplomatic snub, even though it still is a very significant move.
Yeah.
Second, it's important to also remember that this foreign minister in Nigeria is part of the outgoing government, Goodluck Jonathan's government. So I'm not quite sure how that plays into it, but then we have to remember that these ministers soon will change. And the Nigerian foreign minister did also acknowledge President Zuma's comments that he condemned xenophobia in the country. But I think we're right, and we have to just put this into context and remember that the sort of tit-for-tat relations South Africa and Nigeria have had over the years, where we've seen, you know, those, well, what were you saying, Kings, the yellow fever plane?
Yeah, I mean that's the first I remember of this issue. I think it was 2012. and a plane from Nigeria was turned back at Ouatambo. And they said, I think the official reason was the yellow fever documents were seen to be falsified or something.
Yeah, I remember.
And they sent it back, and then Nigeria did the same with another plane shortly after that.
Yeah, and it's been more difficult for South Africans to get visas to be traveling to Nigeria.
So there seems to be this... Yeah, sorry, Greg.
Then there was also the South Africa really pushed Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma to become chairperson of the African Union. And that was against Nigeria publicly declared their non-support of a South African leader because of this thing where South Africa is sort of seen as a bit of a bully, sort of forcing its own agenda on the continent, often ignoring other countries' views. And then there was that crazy story that came out, I can't remember, a couple of years ago or something like that, with that money that came through, I think, through one of the banks and also in cash at Lansiria.
Now, I love this story. Please tell us, break it down, what happened, because I love this
story. I should
have
researched the details, but the story goes something like that because of the arms embargoes on Nigeria and the difficulties for Nigeria to buy weapons to fight Boko Haram, they were trying to channel money through South Africa and see if they could buy arms for their military efforts in sort of regaining control of the northeast of Nigeria. And then the way the money came into South Africa, bringing millions on a plane through Lansiria and also through a bank transfer, didn't quite follow the normal procedure, and it got caught up, you know, with the South African authorities. And the money is still caught up and tied up with the South African authorities, and they haven't got, I think, I can't remember the exact figure, something like $20 million or something like that. They haven't got that money yet. And so there are all these different little things that amount to this tit-for-tat relationship South Africa has with Nigeria. And the weekend's incidents of this High Commissioner being recalled for a conversation, not essentially withdrawn, being brought out for conversation back to Nigeria to talk about xenophobia, would have to say it's the low point of the relationship.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to just look at the timeline. So I think it seems like the sort of yellow fever issue seemed to be sort of where this silliness started. We have this Lansiria cash issue. And then now it's sort of coming into the xenophobia conversation. Now, if I'm not wrong, the office of the presidency in Nigeria called the South African High Commissioner in Nigeria to the presidency to explain on behalf of the government what is going on. Now, all these things, though, they sound a bit silly, like come and explain, you're not being recalled, you're being invited. But I think in diplomatic channels, these are actually like, these things matter.
Look, Kingsley, I mean, the one thing that we established just before the show is that I am a closet geek, right? So one of the things as a closet geek that I used to do was that I used to be a model UN coach. And if there's one thing that you do, model UN, I mean, Security Council, simulated Security Council and General Assembly debate. And if there's one thing that you need to do in the diplomatic scene is always try to take the higher ground.
Okay.
Simple as that. You do stick to your principles, but you always try to stick to the higher ground.
So what do you mean by higher ground?
That you should come off having the moral imperative. Okay. That you should be, you know, seemingly be the country that is trying to extend the hand of free friendship.
So regardless of what's happening, you must appear to be the one who's saying that.
Exactly. Okay. Unless we talk about North Korea.
Okay. Wartime, I imagine it's a bit different. But in like regular diplomacy.
But regular diplomacy. Yeah. And in this instance, I'm sorry, but both these countries, and I do understand, obviously Nigeria and South Africa are the two economic and political powerhouses. Mm. So when it comes to the African continent, they will clash. It's inevitable. However, the way both of them are clashing, it's as if whoever's in charge of international relations in both countries are amateurs at this stage.
Yeah, it just seems like a pissing contest, to be honest.
That's what it turned out.
Mad about our issues? Well, I hope you get the girls that were kidnapped back. And that's such, that's such a horrible thing to say.
Because for me, for the life of me, I do not understand how you point out the fact that 84 South Africans died in your country and we didn't make a big deal about it. 200 of your girls have been kidnapped. And shame, we hope that one day they'll come back.
And we'll support you. Good luck with that. And you sign off on that. Come on.
I'm sorry, but that is honestly it's the lowest blow that you can, apart from obviously declaring war against
like all
each other.
Our, which is,
these are some of the lowest tactics I've ever seen on the international relations scene.
But ongoing with this, it does seem it's just a petty little sort of fight, because it seems even when Nigeria became Africa's biggest economy after they rebased,
I think last year on the rebase,
GDP. A lot of people, anyone who knows anything about this sort of stuff, knew that Nigeria was basically the biggest economy anyway.
It was just a technicality,
because they hadn't rebased their GDP for so long. But now it seems to be that there's this little beef between South Africa and Nigeria because of this, you know, who wants to be number one sort of title and vying for the powerhouse, the economic powerhouse, and sort of vying for business interests, pushing to try and be the number one sort of cultural dominator on the continent, where you have Nigeria with its Bollywood. Nollywood. Excuse me. India's next week, right? Yeah. And then South Africa pushing its DSTV across the continent. But in the end, I think for me, the most worrying thing about these petty squabbles, and there are obviously points where both countries, our diplomatic leaders, our state leaders, yeah. the business community, the arts and culture community cooperate. There's a lot of different points where there is cooperation.
Absolutely.
But what I worry about is that for Africa as then the different African nations to advance, we particularly need cooperation. And I think this really shows just how far we are from that.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Okay. If there's just one final point that I want to raise, is that in as much as, you know, this bomb fight has ended up the way that it has, the issue is that it shows you what's going on within the African Union circles, why the African Union has really been a lame duck for most of its tenure, why it's unable to deal with these things. Because I think that the issues aren't being addressed. It's rather a clash of personalities rather than issues.
I mean, that's something I'm concerned about is, you know, does the AU actually do anything? But we've got somebody a lot more knowledgeable on these things, that know of all things Africa. Simon Allison, are you here with us?
I am here with you.
Fantastic, fantastic. Man, we've just been talking about the South African relations with the continent and especially Nigeria and that deteriorating relationship. And I know you've written a bit about sort of how South Africa is being perceived currently. We've seen cars with South African plates being stoned in Mozambique. We've heard some threats to boycott South African business and South African music. So is it fair to say there's a general trend of anti-South African sentiment around the continent?
Yes, it is fair. But what we need to realize is this is nothing new. It's not just because of this one bout of xenophobia that we're having problems on the continent. This is historical. It goes back a long way. When I travel across Africa, I frequently encounter negative perceptions of my country. I kind of feel the way an American must feel when he goes traveling around the rest of the world. You know, we are perceived as the dominant power with all the negative connotations that implies. We're perceived as arrogant. We're perceived as presumptuous. We're perceived as uncaring of local traditions and cultures because we have the financial and diplomatic might to impose our will, to get what we want on the African continent. And that really has been the problem. And I think we see it very obviously in the news coverage of the rest of Africa. Yeah. Within South Africa, it's actually scandalous how little South African media covers the rest of the continent. Almost every single publication in the country gets its African coverage via foreign sources, such as AFP, Reuters, The Guardian newspaper, The Telegraph newspaper in London. Even the journalists aren't giving Africa the attention it deserves.
Simon, though, it seems that we've hit a particularly low point. You know, there's been protests outside certain South African embassies and commissions around the continent. We've seen what's happening with Nigeria, bringing their High Commissioner back for conversations. Is this a particularly low point in relations across the continent? And I've seen some columns from other newspapers in different countries. And it seems to... South Africa seems to be particularly up for criticism right now.
Absolutely. And it's justified, you know. We are treating foreign nationals pretty appallingly, and that's the response we can expect. And I think it is to Africa's credit and to the credit of African countries, the ones that have protested, that have taken diplomatic action, that they are actually willing to stand up and say, you know what, this is not acceptable. This is not a way that Africans should be treating each other. And you know what? Instead of the South African government criticizing the protests, which is what they've been doing, they should be turning around and saying, you know what, guys, you're absolutely right to protest, and we're sorry, and we're going to take immediate action to fix all this, rather than get very defensive. And I think in particular, the South African reaction to Nigeria has been very interesting. So what Nigeria has done is they have called back their ambassador and deputy ambassador for consultation. Now, in their response, South Africa's Department of International Relations criticized Nigeria for recalling its ambassador. Now, that's a very, very different thing. Nigeria did not recall its ambassador, which is it's a formal diplomatic protest, and it effectively severs diplomatic ties between two countries. Nigeria didn't do that, but South Africa accused them of doing that. It was a sort of knee-jerk reaction And expressed in the statement itself is expressed in very childlike language. You know, it's almost like playground bullies exchanging insults. That's kind of what it reads like. And it's an indication of the, I think, of the insecurities that that South Africa faces on the continent. You know, we know we are the superpower, but also we know we're not liked. And, we don't like that, I think, is what we're finding out. And we don't know how to handle it either. Our diplomats are not showing the tact and restraint that one would expect of diplomats anywhere in the world.
And so, Simon, we're seeing this, we're talking before about this sort of tit-for-tat response between South Africa and Nigeria and other governments across the continent, but I'm interested in what it means for actual cooperation in terms of getting things done. Often when we have issues such as, you know, the girls being kidnapped by Boko Haram or certain all sorts of issues across the continent, there's all these calls in the media and in the public for the African Union to intervene. I wonder about the future and the state of cooperation between African countries given this climate of animosity.
It's a good question. And I overheard Gershwald talking about the failures of the African Union and how it's sort of a lame duck. And I'm actually going to take a different tack on that. I think given its resource constraints, it has no money. The African Union is essentially bankrupt because African countries aren't paying for anything. And given its institutional constraints, you know, it is composed of these member states that bicker and don't get along and don't, you know, agree on anything. Given all that, it actually punches well above its weight in terms of dealing with continental issues. And a lot of the good things that it does, you never see it. It just falls entirely under the radar. Yet on these big issues, we aren't seeing enough of it. And I think that is because the big powers in Africa are not on the same page. So we're talking Kenya, Ethiopia, Nigeria, South Africa, Egypt, Algeria, and Morocco.
Mm.
And Morocco is not even a member of the African Union because the AU recognizes Western Sahara. Now, these big powers, you know, between them, they control more than half of the continent's GDP or something ridiculous like that, and they certainly wield the diplomatic clout. They are not on the same page. Nigeria and South Africa are constantly bickering. Egypt and Ethiopia, their relations are very tense right now over that big dam that Ethiopia is building on the Nile. So what we're seeing is until the big powers in Africa kind of find a way to move forward in the same direction, the African Union itself, there's no way that it can force them to do so.
I mean, thanks for bringing that up. I mean, I'm a big sort of AU doubter, so it's nice for somebody to sort of come forward and say, listen, there is something happening, because, I mean, as far as I was concerned, there's not much going on there. I mean, Simon, my final question on this is just really about back to the Nigerian SA. I just want to be clear that at the end of the day, the relations are still there. The SA High Commission in Nigeria, the Nigerian High Commission in SA, they're still open, they're still functioning, and diplomatic relations still exist, and it's still going strong.
I wouldn't use the word going strong. Okay. That's a little bit overboard, Casey. Okay. They still exist, but it is tense.
Okay.
And, you know, even before the xenophobic stuff, there's a lot of issues going on, particularly visas is one big area that's a problem. Nigerians trying to get visas for South Africa and South Africans trying to get visas for Nigeria. And both countries use the issuing of visas as a political weapon to try and prevent too many nationals from one coming into the other. Also, if you look at the fight against Boko Haram in Nigeria and the alleged involvement of South African mercenaries there, that is another very serious issue. You know, you can understand Nigeria's frustration if there are South African nationals coming in with weapons and fighting on its soil. It's a very delicate thing, and we're not being that upfront with each other. There's also that the problem last year of South Africa confiscating tens of millions of dollars worth of cash, which was apparently intended for an arms deal, which South Africa also blocked. So at every avenue where these two countries could cooperate, they are choosing not to cooperate. And that is very concerning for the continent's future. But having said that, yes, diplomatic relations still do exist, and there is still very close ties, particularly in the business sector, between Nigeria and South Africa. And I think there's simply too much money tied up in those ties. And in South Africa, too many big players, you know, we're talking MTN, Standard Bank, ShopRite, etc., DSTV, that's too much money, too much power for the government to really upset the apple cart and sever relations entirely.
Hmm. I mean, Simon, thanks for clearing that up. I think it's something we'll be watching quite closely. I mean, I can only imagine of the continental implications of the two economic powerhouses having a complete fallout. So we'll keep watching that. Simon, thanks so much for giving us that insight. I'm sure we'll have you again soon.
Yeah, thanks, Kingsley.
Okay, perfect. Thanks so much, man. We're just about to go into a break. Before that, I want to talk a bit about phones. Gashwal, I can see your phone is falling apart, man. So you'll be interested to hear this. It's Cliff Central's first birthday on the 1st of May, and we'll be giving out a ton of smartphones. And you can win just by listening out for the question and submitting your answer on WeChat. Just tap connect, then competition on the menu. We'll be giving away a Samsung Galaxy S4, and the question is to spot the odd one out. And the list is Khlubi Mboya, Gareth Armstrong, and Trevor Gumbi. You need to spot the odd one out. You need to answer on WeChat, and you could win a Samsung S4.
And I think we just have to emphasize that. Yeah. You have to answer on WeChat,
yeah.
Not Twitter, not Facebook. Get WeChat and answer please. That way if you want to win the phone.
We keep getting so many answers, so please.
Don't WhatsApp Kingsley directly.
Oh, I mean, you can do that, but you would get a phone answer. We'll be back right after
this. You might
get
a date, though.
It has been locked away from the eyes of the world, chained, never to be released. But now, it wants to get out. Stay tuned to Cliff Central weekdays to find out how you can unleash the Jeep Renegade. Find hidden codes and videos posted by Jeep SA, and you could win Jeep Renegade prizes. As well as become the person to single-handedly unleash the Jeep Renegade upon the shores of South Africa. Are you renegade enough?
I'm a renegade, I just hit the ground running.
Visit unleashrenegade.co.za to find out. T's and C's apply.
And now tuned in to the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. Welcome back. Just a quick reminder, we're giving away a Samsung S4 during the show. Please just type your answer in on WeChat. The question is to spot the odd one out. And the options are Khlubi Mboya, Gareth Armstrong, Trevor Gumbi, and you need to spot the odd one out and you can win a Samsung S4. Guys, I just want to pick up on what we were discussing just before we went on to the break. There's this whole narrative that so many countries supported South Africa during the struggle for democracy. And actually the song we led in with at the start of the show was a Nigerian song pushing for democracy in South Africa. Mm. So I always wonder, is it fair to go to South Africa and be like, hey, we really supported you, now you guys owe us. Is that fair? Or is it... You know, is that actually fair? You supported somebody out of your sort of moral decision.
Mm.
Is it fair to always bring that up and be like, guys, we supported you. The only reason you're free is because of us. Is that fair?
Can I come in there? Because, yeah. You know, this is what I find absolutely fascinating about that argument. Is that I don't think that foreign nationals that come to South Africa are thinking that we gave them support.
And therefore, you have to let me in. They're at the border, right. Say you have to let me in.
So let's look at, I mean, some of the, you know, because obviously we also have this debate around who are the people, you know, entering South Africa.
Yeah.
We have Chinese, Pakistani, Bangladeshi, Ethiopian, Somali people. People, they don't necessarily have a direct link with struggle stalwarts that went and sought refuge in those countries.
Mm.
It's a global phenomenon, for goodness sake. If you're living in a country that's pretty crappy,
yeah.
You're going to look for a country that has a you know, that gives you better opportunity.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. That is why people from Central America and South America are trying to make it into the U.S. That is why 900 people drowned in the Mediterranean, leaving Northern Africa for Italy, for goodness sake. So for me, this whole argument that keeps on coming up that, yeah, but guys, you know, we once upon a time you helped us out, but now we're inundated. It's for me, it's one of those narratives. And believe me, Kingsley, I've been inundated with this stuff.
Okay.
There's a list of reasons why South Africans keep on using, they keep on using to justify xenophobia. And one of those is the fact that just because once upon a time, a few thousand of us when your country is seeking refuge doesn't mean now we need to be inundated and the borders are open in the world.
Oh, so you're hearing it used by South Africans to say, hey, guys, we don't owe you forever. Oh, that's
exactly
interesting. Okay.
Exactly. So,
okay.
I don't know. For me, it's just, and it's not, I mean, I don't think that the average Malawian person that's trying to irk out a living in downtown Joburg is going to say that once upon a time.
He's trying to cash in on a debt and say, hey, you owe me, so I must come through. Sorry, Greg.
But I do think, I agree with you, Gashwal, that the average South African person, the exile offered and the funds given in support of ANC and other liberation movements, isn't a prominent thing in their mind these days when they think about how we will treat foreigners in this country, because it's too distant for your average South African. It's too far removed. Most people weren't in exile. And even the exile period was decades ago now.
And it was by definition happening somewhere else. Do you know what I mean? If you weren't there, you did not witness it for yourself.
So it is hard for your average South African. I don't think that's worth appealing to your average South African.
Mm.
It's worth saying, but I don't think people are going to respond to the call. Don't be xenophobic because these countries' governments supported us in our liberation struggle. But I do think there is a moral imperative from the state of South Africa to recognize the support offered by these other governments. When the state is dealing with these instances in terms of protecting foreign nationals, and I think all foreign nationals, we should respond and protect them just because they're human beings, not because necessarily their governments or their political parties or their people supported our liberation movement. But first of all, it should be because we need to protect other human beings and the right to life and human dignity. Yeah. But I think the state should be propelled into recognizing these things even earlier, and it should just be an extra reason to treat foreign nationals as human beings and as people, when you can recognize that, hey, we were in this fight together, this fight that got us here, we're in it together. And I think that should propel them to take action and defend the rights of other Africans and other nationalities in South Africa sooner.
You see, the thing for me about it, Greg, is that it's always difficult to measure the moral imperative.
Yeah.
It's virtually impossible. Mm. Because with the moral imperative, you're doing it because it's the right thing to do. Right now, the UN and all these other wonderful international institutions have put together all these various treaties and things that we had to sign onto, which says that this is how you need to deal with foreign nationals that come into your country, whether immigration laws, people that seek refuge, and all of those other things. Now, the thing is, South Africa signed onto these things, and largely we're compliant with them. But the biggest disconnect, especially with xenophobia and xenophobia that is fueled by a belief that, look, yeah, you are taking away or you're robbing me of my economic opportunity, obviously it is the responsibility of government to start communicating these things to people, to make them understand that we can't just build a wall and say to Zimbabweans, you can't enter this country anymore.
Mm.
We can't. I mean, if someone enters the country illegally and they say, I'm here seeking refuge, I couldn't just get a visa or passport and say, yeah, guys, I'm coming illegally because I'm running for my life because of the political situation. That message needs to be translated to ordinary people, and it's not happening.
Absolutely, Gershwell. I mean, that's something I want to ask sort of our next interviewee about. We're talking to Professor Achiel Mbembe from the Wits Institute of Social and Economic Research, the Wiser Institute. Professor, how are you today? Hello, Professor, are you here with us?
Yes, hello.
Oh, fantastic. How are you today?
Yes, I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Good, good. Thank you for coming on. Now, Professor, you spoke last week at an event and you said something I found quite interesting. You said South Africa must remember or rethink what the Africa in its name stands for. What do you mean by that?
I mean, we all have in mind all that is going on right now.
Mm.
We have borders that were basically carved out by Europeans in 1884.
Yeah.
Those borders have not been dismantled. So nobody is saying that we should be traveling to other countries illegally. Nobody is in favor of illegal immigration.
Mm-hmm.
These things happen. We are not in favor neither of killing people just because they are foreigners. So some solution has to be found in the spirit of opening up Africa to itself so that we become a power in the world in which we live in. Because as long as we are fragmented, as long as we make one step forward, two steps backward, the world won't take us seriously. And this applies not only to South Africa, but to the entire continent.
That's interesting. I know we've also just been talking about how not only the plight of Africans, of foreign Africans in South Africa, but also around the world, and with the immigrants traveling across the Mediterranean into Europe, and the plight
it applies to black people in the world. As we speak, Baltimore in the U.S. is burning. Black people are killed by the police in America almost on a regular basis. black people are unwelcomed almost everywhere in the world. So we have a particular responsibility to turn our own continent, which is colossal, which is immense, which is full of wealth and riches, to turn it into a peaceful place where to be black will no longer be a liability. I really believe that that is what the times we live in are calling us for.
Prof, if I can ask you, I mean, something that I find very interesting as part of the debate and the narrative amongst activists in this space right now against xenophobia is what you just mentioned right at the beginning of the conversation, this idea that borders are artificial, they weren't there in existence, someone else made this decision, and now we're happy to reinforce those colonial ideas and those notions. But I mean, for the average South African, in their minds, you know, a Zimbabwean, a Malawian, an Ethiopian, a Pakistani is here to take away the economic opportunity. Would ordinary people on the ground, does this debate actually matter to them?
No, it has to matter, because you know what? Their survival depends on borders being spaces of exchange and encounter. The survival of the poor South African depends on MTN, Standard Bank, Absa, FNB, Shoprite, and all those big companies investing in Nigeria, in Zimbabwe, in Mozambique, making lots of money there, repatriating that money here, paying taxes so that the state, for instance, can sustain the huge bill on social grant. All those things are interconnected.
Mm.
Of course, I mean, we cannot be advocating illegal migration, because those who migrate illegally always end up paying a really heavy price for their existence in a place where they are not welcome. But South Africa cannot turn into a new pariah state. It cannot isolate itself from the rest of the continent, because it will pay a heavier price than any other country. After all, the rest of the continent is the second major destination of South African investment. So those things have to be considered carefully. And leaders, responsible people, cannot be making irresponsible statements.
I mean, I hear you, Prof. I think, I mean, what worries me is that, I mean, since the 50s and way back then with Kwame Nkrumah and some of those other liberation leaders, we've been trying to push for Pan-Africanism and talk about it and make it a reality. But I mean, from how things are looking now, it doesn't seem like we've made too much progress. I mean, so what are we getting wrong? What do we need to do differently?
You see, we have made some progress. We do have a continental public sphere. The African Union is pushing forward with a whole variety of projects. We just have to be steadfast. I think that, first of all, we have to say that if there is one single African country in the world everybody wants to see succeed, it's South Africa. The goodwill is immense. We shouldn't be wasting it. We should really be very careful, deal with this matter humanely, and contribute, therefore, in promoting the project of African liberation, without which nobody will respect black people in the world. People won't respect black South Africans alone. They'll respect black people if Africa can stand on its own feet. And that's what the work we are called upon to be doing. And once again, nobody should be advocating illegal migration. If we have to move towards an Africa without border, this has to be done responsibly and collectively. South Africa cannot open its borders alone. We have to do it in a phased, managed manner.
Prof, I mean, I accept everything that you're saying there, and you know, I just listen to what you're saying, and I'm thinking of the disconnect between what you're saying and versus what government is saying and versus what ordinary people on the ground are saying. The type of person that would say that I'm being robbed of economic opportunity, that our borders are wide open, that these are the problems that we have. And then on top of that, we have a government that's not willing to speak to its citizenry in real and hard facts. We have people that are resistant to using terms like xenophobia. We have people, you know, we have Batabile Dlamini, for example, throwing a fit in Isipingo because the EFF has helped out with blankets and mattresses. So do you understand what I'm saying? Is that I'm worried that this debate and what you're saying, which I think is the correct approach, is only limited to a particular circle. And the people that really matter, the people that should be implementing this, government and ordinary people on the ground, are not listening to these voices. How do we start getting what you're saying to ordinary folks so that we don't see the scenes that we saw in the last 3 weeks?
I agree with your characterization. I think that the South African government has to come clean on this matter. One understands that the government is under pressure, on the one hand, from its own people who are crying for change.
Yeah.
Wherever you go today, especially among black communities, people are asking for change, and they want it now. On the other hand, the government has commitments with the rest of the continent. Mm. The government knows very well that we cannot be killing foreigners here without this having implications for our investments in Nigeria, for instance. Mm. Without this having implications for our investment in mining in Guinea-Conakry or in Mali. So what the government is trying to do is it is trying to speak a double language. It has to stop doing that. It has to come clean on what are the stakes. We are likely to pay more for the disorders that are going on than other countries. As far as the people are concerned, there's nothing to be done except educating them. We have to educate the people, and we have to attend to the cry for transformation in matters of jobs, on matters of education, healthcare. That is how people will stop scapegoating other people. Right now, there are no jobs to be stolen. Even if we expel all the foreigners, it won't mean that there are jobs waiting for us out there to go and take. We can take the goods, but goods only last for a week or something like that. They won't last for a long time. So education is absolutely important. We won't do without educating the people.
But, Prof, I mean, especially in light of what we're seeing in South Africa, where there is a, not necessarily just a failure, but a shortcoming at times in terms of what government has promised and in terms of what it's delivering when it comes to service delivery, doesn't it become politically expedient for a government to latch onto the narrative on the ground?
They do that everywhere. They do that everywhere in France, in Scandinavia. When they fail, They use these phony mechanisms to make sure that the anger is not directed at them, but it's directed at some other scapegoat. So in that matter, I mean, South Africa is not exceptional. But one would expect a bit more from a government of a country that has known the violence of discrimination and segregation for so long. There is a responsibility when the world has helped you to break the chains of oppression to not fall into the kind of repetition of what was inflicted upon you in the way in which you inflicted upon a weaker than yourself. As I have been saying, this doesn't mean that South Africa should become a land of illegal migration. But the migrants who are here legally should be protected. They should be protected, and they should try to integrate in the society. I believe, for instance, that all Somali shopkeepers or who own shops in townships should learn to speak the local language, for instance. And many are already doing that. They should integrate. They should become part of those communities and give back something to the community. That's how they will be protected by the people they serve. in the very places where they work. So a lot of things can be done. We need strong leadership, principled leadership, to make sure that we do not become once again the shame of the world.
Absolutely, Professor.
It doesn't help us, our standing in the world, when the world sees black people being killed on the street by other black people just because they don't belong here.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Professor, for that insight. I really hope the government, you know, hears you and we start moving in that direction.
We just have to make sure that, I mean, the government hears and then we get out of this mess.
Absolutely. I mean, thanks to people like you. Just keep doing the work you do and hopefully we'll, you know, start moving forward. Thank you, Professor.
Thanks so much. Thank you. Bye.
Fantastic. Now, I mean, Greg, I know we only have, you know, so much time left, but I'm just curious about the state, you know, in the townships and in the CBD and in Hillbrow and Mayfair right now. We've seen the army and heavy police presence in some areas, and the government and the president actually has put out a statement saying that he's authorized military action until the end of June. So, I mean, does that mean that we're going to be seeing the army, you know, up and down the streets between now and June, or what can we expect now on that front?
I wouldn't expect to see the army on the streets all the time between now and June, but we can actually.
Yeah.
So yesterday in areas such as Mayfair, Hillbrow, and the Johannesburg CBD, the army was deployed in an operation in collaboration with the police, in supporting the police. Largely, those communities are known for the high number of foreign nationals that reside there, and they conducted stop and search operations, and I think they arrested, I think it was 50 foreign nationals who didn't have the proper documentation.
Mm-hmm.
So that followed two raids on the Jeppe Men's Hostel, you know, just outside of downtown Johannesburg, and the Mandala Hostel in Alexandra, which are often seen as hotspots for violence and xenophobia, and they're largely symbols. I think that's what was happening, what we saw yesterday.
Okay.
We saw the police with the army in support being sent into these hostels, which have always been held up as symbols of sort of violence in South Africa. And even if, so for example, the Alexandra hostel hasn't been particularly associated with the xenophobic violence. The Jeppe hostel did make a number of threats and looted some stores and caused some sort of chaos in that area. But I think what we saw was the government really trying to send a message to other African states and the world that South Africa and the state of South Africa does care about foreign nationals in our country, and we're willing to take decisive action. And I think the reason I say they were really trying to send a message is because they raided these hostels with the media in tow. The media came in there filming everything, and I wasn't there, but I'd find it quite interesting to sort of hear that conversation as to whether the media just sort of tagged along without any pushback from the police, or whether the media actually really forced their way in there and took their own risks to come in there. But from the images I saw, it looked like the media was an extra partner on the operation.
And sort of following along.
And then after those large statements sent out to foreign countries, we've had, I think what yesterday was a statement to South Africa, both in acknowledging and trying to do something about the problem with sort of the migration issues we have here, where there are a lot of undocumented migrants in all sorts of situations, and that's a concern for voters. And so I think what the government and the police and everything was trying to do is just say, hey, we'll also care about that. And let's be honest, it is an issue. So personally, I find it very hard to see the police and the army on the streets of Hillbrow searching foreign nationals for their papers so soon as well after the xenophobic violence.
Yeah.
It almost seems like the next day we turn the switch and actually we do target these guys as a state. But I think it's about trying to acknowledge these different pressures on this issue.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, Greg, I mean, we will really keep coming back to you as you follow this closely. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. But just before we wrap up, we do have a winner for the Samsung S4. Mfundo Dlala, congratulations. You've won yourself a new Samsung S4 courtesy of Cliff Central on our first birthday.
Yay!
Congratulations, man. Our team will be in touch with you so you can get your brand new phone. That's all the time we have. We'll see you next Tuesday, 1 to 2 p.m. on the Daily Maverick Show.
CliffCentral.com.